Basel III Endgame will make it harder for consumers to buy a house or a car. It'll hurt the small businesses that rely on loans to grow, and it'll reduce savings for people with money in pension funds. Regulators propose capital requirements would take a toll on families, seniors, farmers, and small businesses. Washington, scrap Basel III Endgame and start over.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another edition of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, has Donald Trump already moved on from Tuesday's midterms? Sure feels like it. Plus, a few lessons to learn from Tuesday in addition to what we talked about late on Tuesday night, and how Democrats will make sense of them in 2020. As usual, remember, we're taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday. That's November 8th this week, so it's all up to date as of then. Let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. As always, we have senior politics editor Charlie Mentesian here. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Scott.
Have you slept at all since election night?
About 3 hours.
Yeah, all right. That's good. That's enough to function on a podcast such as this one. And also in the studio, we have one of the members of Politico's White House team, Chris Catalago. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you.
All right, let's jump right in. Time for our first data point, two. There are now two top-level jobs in President Donald Trump's administration that he needs to fill. Before the election, of course, we had UN Ambassador Nikki Haley leaving. And yesterday, the president said Attorney General Jeff Sessions was out. So, Chris, since Tuesday's midterms, the president has sacked his attorney general, picked a fight with the media in the East Room of the White House. He's about to head to Paris. There's all sorts of stuff swirling around about the Mueller investigation and just about every other thing. Has the president just moved on from Tuesday night, from the midterms already, after all this anticipation?
Yeah, we thought he was going to have to move on because he might have even done a little worse than he ended up doing. In fact, even when he tried to talk about some of the gains that the party made, some of the places where he did have, an impact, states like Florida, you can make the argument Ohio, certainly in Georgia, he stepped all over that sort of brief message and just immediately launched into this solo act that we've seen him have after sort of awkwardly playing party leader.
Are you talking about the diatribe against House members who lost after refusing, quote, the embrace?
Yeah. So Donald Trump basically came out and by name called out a bunch of House members and House candidates who didn't hug him closely as many of the folks in the Senate did. We had Leader McConnell come out and talk about how he was going to help guard the president against presidential harassment, which is what he's calling sort of. And I think part of this is basically Trump coming to grips with something that he hadn't fully come to grips with, which was divided government and this sort of level of the level of pain that he's going to be in when Democrats start, going after him.
It's interesting that you say that he hadn't come to grips with this, because this is something, obviously, we didn't know for sure that the House was going to flip, but this is something that we have been talking about for a while. But it's the president has a unique ability to kind of block out, I think, in his mind, the parts of the country that don't like him very much. And you just look at his travel schedule, right, and like where he was before the midterms. And even when he did end up visiting three states that he didn't win, but most of the time that he spent in those three states was in parts of the state that love him.
He still was focusing on this very, very narrow path to keeping the House. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he talked about it, he still seemed to think that that was possible. He hadn't dispatched any large number of folks within the White House to start really looking into what it would mean if they lost the House. He talked about it like he thought this could still happen. And so when you say coming to grips, I mean, his view on polls is largely shaped by his own 2016 race. And, he talks about fake polls and he basically looks at these things as this large undervote and people not, these polls not being reflective of these races. So, the fact that some of this was sort of a rude awakening for him, he'd never lost an election. And we've seen in his actions since then that things are not going to look good for him when you start have a couple dozen Democrats who are running against him, cutting into his TV time. And, we're just going to continue to see what it looks like when it's not all on Trump time.
Charlie, obviously that rude awakening is coming also in the form of House Democrats who are going to be digging into his trash over the next weeks, months, years.
Right. But I also think that we're almost beginning this discussion from a It's almost as if it's rooted in a flawed assumption, which is the idea that he has any grasp of the political map and political dynamics. I mean, I don't think he has any whatsoever. And I don't mean that, you know, as just sort of a arbitrary criticism. What I mean is he's not somebody who has been steeped in politics his whole life or his career. All he knew was candidates that would come up and hit him up with a tin cup for money. And then he runs a single race, real race. And he goes seat of the pants and he wins in an epic upset. So that is his frame of reference. He doesn't know the House map. He doesn't distinguish between districts. He probably doesn't even distinguish that much between the House and the Senate. He probably doesn't understand their different constituencies. And so in his mind, and we also know the way his mind works, we know the way he consumes information. It's highly selective, which is a charitable way of describing it. So in his mind, he wins an epic victory against all odds. What he knows in his mind and how he processes it, we can pretty much assume based on what we know about him, which is that he has defied history. And unlike all of the other loser presidents that were crushed in midterm elections, he won an epic victory by saving the Senate for the Republican Party and the losers and malcontents that did not embrace him in the House and didn't have him into the districts. Well, they made a big mistake and made their bed and they're going to suffer. And I also agree on the House Democrats. I mean, I don't think he fully has wrapped his arms around just how loathed he is. He kind of gets the idea of the resistance, but I don't think he understands how House Democrats really feel about him.
Well, but here's something arguing against the idea that he doesn't have understanding. We know that one of Trump's skills is his ability to change the conversation and to try and change the direction of things. And so let's talk about Jeff Sessions, right? The big question here is what a new attorney general means for the investigation by Robert Mueller into Russian interference in the 2016 election. And we know that Trump knows that. And we know that that is part of the reason why Sessions left yesterday, the day after this big election result. So Chris, take us through what's going on here. I guess to start off, what do we know about Sessions' temporary replacement, Matthew Whitaker?
So this is a guy who, you know, in the broadest sense is a loyalist, and a loyalist not like Jeff Sessions was in like every possible sense that you can be, except for the fact that he had recused himself. You know, the one area where he broke with Donald Trump was the one area where Trump sort of needed him the most. And so you have a former in Whitaker, a former college football player, which Trump has mentioned. He has had some former football players on his staff that he tends to like. He likes people kind of in that tough guy mold. This is someone who memes are already being created about doing Olympic weightlifting. He's bald. He has the tough edge look to him. He's written op-eds already calling you know, early in 2017 for the investigation to come to a close, the Mueller investigation. So this is someone who has said this thing has gone on way too long, sees it very much in the same way that Trump does. The question is, who is he going to bring on to replace Sessions on a full-time basis? And is that person tied in any way to the investigation where they would have to recuse himself? I mean, that's really the question. The list is long, and we've seen a list includes a whole bunch of names, including Chris Kobach from Kansas, and you know, anyone from on the other side, Rudy Giuliani. Of course, he's already worked on that. So would he have to recuse himself?
The politics around replacing Sessions. Mm-hmm. I mean, so we've got Whitaker, who's in this mold that Trump likes, in there now. The loyalist, as you mentioned, whoever the full-time replacement is going to be, is obviously there's going to be a lot of questions about all the stuff that you mentioned regarding Russia and the Mueller probe, and but at the same time, we see, you know, Republicans have expanded their Senate majority. They could have as many as I think 54 seats, seats when by the time this confirmation battle comes up. So does that give Trump more of a free hand in terms of replacing Sessions than he would have had before the midterms?
In this particular area, it's still going to be tough. I think when it comes to other cabinet replacements, Interior, some of these others that he's looked at, Homeland Security, there's more wiggle room, certainly. The Senate, you know, they talked a lot during the campaign about the Senate being important, not only for judges but for cabinet appointments and other appointments that he might make. The other thing I'd think about when it comes to Sessions' role in particular is, can he find someone who's already received Senate confirmation, someone like an Azar, who could then slide into that role
And that's the Health and Human Services
Health Secretary. And Human Services Secretary. And so they wouldn't have to face sort of a whole redo. That would definitely smooth out the process if he could do that. This is not like an easy job to fill at the moment. I mean, there's a lot of people who – there was talk about Lindsey Graham potentially doing it. But all along, I think he said, despite this sort of attack dog role that he's embraced, he said he'd much rather stay in the Senate. Especially in the position that he's in right now. So, yeah, I mean, this is not going to be an easy thing for him to fill. We know what he wants. You know, he's talked about. We see the AG role as very much this sort of independent role now, even though people try to make Obama's AG Eric Holder out to be someone who was beholden to him. But you know, Trump wants a Bobby Kennedy. Trump has said that he wants someone who basically is loyal to him as they would be their brother.
Do we have a sense of the timeline on exactly when this nomination might arrive?
No, I mean people were thinking that the firing would come sooner rather than later. Obviously, it came a day after the midterm, so I think he would rather do it soon. But I guess some of it will depend on Whitaker and his role. You got to remember, Trump has a lot of jobs to fill in addition to the cabinet. His, you know, as we talk about these Democratic investigations coming down, he has a barren counsel's office right now that he needs to work on filling as well, because they're going to be spending their time responding to subpoena requests.
All right. Well, Chris and Charlie, that actually makes for a good transition to our next data point, this talk about the Senate and the degree to which Trump does or does not have breathing room there right now. Our next data point is 4, and that is potentially the advantage that Republicans could go into the next Congress with in the Senate with a 54-seat majority if things turn out the way they're going right now. That's with the caveat of Rick Scott has a very narrow lead in the Florida Senate race, which is going to be subject to a recount. Martha McSally has a lead in Arizona's Senate race, where they're still counting ballots. Neither of those races called yet, obviously. But then there were flips for Republicans in Indiana, North Dakota, and Missouri on Tuesday night. Democrats grabbed one back by flipping the Republican-held seat in Nevada. All that adds up to a potential for a 54-seat Republican majority. And we're going to use that as a jumping-off point now to talk about the Senate and its role as a staging ground for 2020. Let's bring in James Arkin, who covered the Senate races for us this year. James, good to see you.
Good to be here.
And on the line from Chicagoland, we have national political correspondent Natasha Kurecki. Natasha, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
All right. So, James, I want to start with you. What was the GOP strategy for how to make the most of this Senate map that we have spent the last 2 years covering, and how did it go?
So the strategy was sort of twofold. First, obviously, they had 10 races in states that President Trump won in 2016 that had Democratic incumbents. They decided very early on to narrow the focus. Mitch McConnell, says, don't fall in love with the map. And it became pretty clear pretty quick that states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin were not going to be competitive. And so they narrowed their focus into the states that he won most overwhelmingly. And then they really rode along with Trump. The president went to visit these states time and time again. Candidates really aligned themselves with him and almost never broke with the president on anything. And they just relied on being able to turn out his voters in places like Missouri, Indiana, North Dakota, the three that they were able to flip, kind of riding President Trump's popularity in those states. So they aligned very closely with him, and they also narrowed what they were looking at. They narrowed their expectations for what they would be able to flip and where their focus would be, which allowed them to really invest heavily in those states that they thought they had the best chance.
And ultimately resulting in an expansion of the majority, which is really, in a lot of ways, that's what's kind of helping Republicans see the silver lining on election night, right? They lost the House very decisively at this point. We're already up over, I think, the 31st Democratic House gain was just called a few minutes ago as we were here in the studio. The Democrats picked up 7 governorships. Obviously, Republicans protected governorships in Florida and Ohio and Georgia and some other places, but it's the Senate that's really kind of clouding the picture a little bit. And as we talked about, it took place on a different playing field, but there's also the results matter.
Yeah. I mean, if you talk to Democrats, they feel like they did a great job to limit their losses by, saving West Virginia and Montana to states with moderate incumbents and by protecting those Midwest states. But, I mean, the goal for Republicans all along was protect the majority and maybe expand it by a few to give themselves a little bit of breathing room in terms of vote margin and to give themselves a little bit of breathing room in terms of, you know, keeping the Senate in 2020 and going forward. And so, you know, like you said, there's a difference between a 52-seat majority if Florida and Arizona both go Democrats' way, or a 54-seat majority if they both go Republicans' way. But if Republicans end with a 53 or 54 majority, they've done exactly what they set out to do, which is protect and slightly expand their majority and give themselves the breathing room that they need.
Charlie, what's your overarching take on how the Senate kind of fits into what we saw on election night?
Well, I mean, to me, it's just it was a further expression of the way we vote now and the level of polarization that nobody splits tickets anymore, and we're moving toward a system in which every state will have senators that align themselves with the presidential party. We saw that in 2016, where I think every Senate race, every state voted with the same candidate that they voted for at the national level in the presidential election, and we're moving in that direction. We saw that the other day. The president had great success in the red states, ousted some members who might have otherwise been in pretty good shape, paid attention to their home turf. He came in and really blew things up, and I think that was my big takeaway from the Senate map, at least.
With all that in mind, the Senate is now kind of changing positions from this big midterm focus we've had on it. It's becoming a staging ground, really, for a large number of Democratic candidates or potential Democratic candidates, I should say, who may challenge Donald Trump in 2020. We've got Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, Bernie Sanders. The list goes on. Natasha, you've been tracking this already. We know that the 2020 race didn't just begin this week. It's been going on for a while, and you've been writing about it. But can you talk to us about what the next stage is going to look like as a lot of these senators decide whether or not to pull the trigger and kind of make their moves in that direction in the next weeks and months?
Right. I mean, who are we kidding? This did start months ago, didn't it? I think the midterms provided excellent cover for a lot of the senators and other candidates too, to, you know, go out, test the waters, talk to different crowds, try to raise some money for them and just sort of show their worth. But right, I mean, in the immediate, we had, you know, a great story Thursday. We had a great story about how the Senate was continue to be a staging ground for just to showcase some of these senators, much like what happened in the Kavanaugh hearings. But as far as the actual campaigns, I think what we're going to start seeing is people are starting to staff up. I mean, if the field's going to be as big as everyone's talking, it's like it's going to be, there's only going to be so many really, you know, top tier sort of, you know, how many great campaign finance directors will there be, or managers will there be. So I think everyone's trying to scoop up that talent. But as far as announcing, there's all this jockeying that we're going to see with that as well. When do you announce? There's benefits perhaps for lesser known names to maybe announce earlier. But then there's this whole game with when do you file your campaign finance report? And David Siders actually had a really good story about that as well. That some people might hold off on an actual, you know, they can announce later on and file later on so they have a more robust report. But we'll probably start seeing, like, you know, the whole exploratory committees start coming out. You know, there'll be some buzz, but I think a lot of the big announcements might be happening after the new year.
There was one thing you said I want to just dig into a little bit more, the kind of hiring up of staff. I mean, how long is it going to take for these people to start picking over the bones of some of the campaigns that just, you know, died a couple days ago to like scavenge the people away for 2020? Is that happening already, essentially? Or that's incredible.
Right. I think the calls started actually before when a lot of these people were going through, when you had Harris and Booker and so forth going through Iowa. I mean, they were meeting with these down ballot staff members, and they're already talking to them then, and you know, just sort of like, hey, you know, I'm a nice guy, wouldn't you like to work for me or advocate for me later on? Just sort of doing like intros. What I keep hearing from people is, you better, you know, if you are serious and you want a good staff, that you better talk to the staff now and then talk to your family later about if you're going to run or not. Lock people down when you can if you want the best of the best to work for you.
Chris, what's the Trump campaign doing on that front? We've seen a really good drumbeat of stories from Politico over the last couple of weeks about the kind of coming refocus on the campaign from people who might be leaving the White House to join it, or the reorganization of the campaign and the super PAC that are backing Donald Trump as they immediately flip the switch from midterms to presidential.
Yeah, the president, a lot of the folks within the political shop, the political director, Bill Stepien, the public liaison's office, a guy named Justin Clark, the spokeswoman in the political shop, Jessica Ditto, a lot of these people have been planning for a while to jump over to the campaign. They've been working really closely already with the campaign to set up this barrage of rallies that the president has had. And I think, if you look at the rallies, I know we've talked about this before, but all the signs are Donald Trump signs. The tenor of the rallies is very much torqued toward him. So, you can make the argument that from the first rally I think he had, which was in Pennsylvania, to the last one he had before the eve of the midterms, they're all Donald Trump 2020 rallies already. And, his campaign has been up and running basically the whole time. It never really stopped. And it will continue to this day. The question I have about his campaign now, I think that we all have, is like, what's it going to look like? His first 2016 campaign was so unorthodox.
When you say look like, are you talking about the message?
The structure. And the structure. Like, is it going to be the traditional, it's certainly not going to be the several, however many thousand Hillary Clinton had in Brooklyn. It doesn't need to be, is what the Trump folks say. It can
be all about him.
It can be like a lot leaner. It can be the people who organize, the people who organize the rallies, and then he kind of has this loosely affiliated network of folks on the ground in these states that he'll continue to turn to. These are people who have like been flying with him on Air Force One when he goes back from midterm rallies. So he's got like a handful of sort of loyalists who are in each of these states on the ground already that they can turn to. But again, like maybe he shifts gears. Maybe it does become a bigger operation. We have people who have been sort of asking the campaign manager, what is this thing going to look like? And that'll be something that I think will be answered in the next few months.
There's questions about the structure. Are there questions about the message at this point? I mean, should we expect anything different than what we've already seen from Trump in 2016 and that during the midterms, but this laser focus on what we would call Trump's base, but some of that is people who have not traditionally been in the Republican base, but Trump has kind of brought them into his corner. And is that going to continue, or should we expect to see something different?
Yeah, that's the one thing with him that he really dictates more than anyone else, which
right.
is sort of, we talk a lot about him being his own communications director. He's also sort of his own campaign manager and strategist. So I think it'll depend. I also kind of think it'll depend on whether he does have sort of that one signature thing to point to that he did do with Democrats that could be sort of a crossover message. Infrastructure now very much is sort of a punchline. But if there is anything that he could do where he crosses the aisle, that might be somewhere where he could, pick up some stray voters that aren't part of his base. But we talk about the places that he went over the midterm campaign. Those are very much the same places that he'll be returning to.
Mm-hmm. And so not just the places he won, but you've written about his he wants to focus on Minnesota, and he visited some kind of Trump country areas of Minnesota, and there's a few other states out
potentially
there.
Potentially Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few, but we kind of know where he's going. We know what his playbook is essentially. The question is does he go off of that in any way? And the thing that is his folks are pointing to that I think some Democrats are certainly concerned about right now are two states in particular, Ohio and Florida. And if he's able to keep them and which he's shown that, he is strong there based on the candidates he supported in the midterms, that's going to be an issue for Democrats.
Got it. All right. Plenty to look out for going forward. Thank you all for joining us to talk it through. Natasha, thank you.
Thank you.
And James, thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
We got a big roundtable to say goodbye to. Chris, thank you very much for being here.
Yes, thank you.
And Charlie, thank you as always.
Thank you, Scott.
And a big thank you to all of you listening to this episode as well. Our show was produced this week by Jenny Ahmed, with help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is our executive producer. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like the Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Once again, thank you for tuning in. Can't wait to talk to you again next week.